when I get to meet someone in a meeting that's not, you know, regular at NAVA, and we got so many great people here, but I go to Triangle occasionally, and I met the lady that we're going to hear tonight, and she really, the message really stuck with me, and I look forward to going back, and she was one of the raisins on the meetings that I go to there. I really enjoy listening to her, and one of the good things about being involved in a speaker meeting is when you meet somebody like that, you get to throw their name in the hat and say, let's get this person and get the rest of the story. So it's an honor to you, Lisa. You're at home here tonight. It says a lot that so many of your friends are here tonight and to support you. So you're home here, and I'll give you Lisa.
Can you guys hear me? Can you still hear me? Okay. Everybody, my name is Lisa, and I'm an alcoholic. When I got here tonight, there was like 10 people here. I was like, perfect, there's only going to be 10 people. Now the room is filled up, and my heart's beating a little bit more. And I haven't been here, actually, in about 15 years. When I first got sober, I was a very much a regular here. I went to some of the nighttime meetings. I probably went to every NAVA AA dance, and especially the Halloween dance. Those were really a lot of fun. I've got some great stories about that I'll tell you after the meeting. And then the 11:30, I think it is, on Sundays. So there's a lot of great sobriety here. And, you know, one thing I need to say first right off the bat is, you know, I'm just another garden variety person in recovery. And the only thing I can do is what the big book talks about is I can't transmit anything that I don't have. And the only thing that I do have is my experience, strength, and hope. And if you can't hear me, just somebody scream in the back and say, you know, I can't hear you. What I was taught when I first got sober is, you know, to go back to what it was like, what happened, and what it's like today. And then I'm supposed to qualify my sobriety date. But one thing I do need to say right off the bat for me is that the principle behind the first step is honesty. So I won't be honest unless I tell you all of my story, or at least most of it, in relation to alcohol and drugs, because I'm an alcoholic and an addict. And I can't leave that part of my story out. So if it offends somebody, I'm just saying that right off the bat. I apologize. My sobriety date is It's July 3rd, 1989. And I came in through AA, and I've stayed in AA since then. I am, just my experience is that I have one white chip, and I don't say that to get a pat on the back. I know for me today that my sobriety is based upon what I'm doing today in this moment. It's not about what I did yesterday or what I might do tomorrow. I just hope that I can stay sober until I go to sleep tonight. That's all I hope for. Because when I got here, I couldn't stay sober. Just the thought of staying sober for even half a day was beyond me. But I'll give you a little bit of what it was like. But one thing I do want to do is I want to tell you something, some things that you guys have taught me. And, you know, if you're new and you're in this room and you've just been around just for a little bit, what I did here when I got sober was to get a connection to something that's bigger than you. It could be a tree, I guess, if that works for somebody, but it could be the higher power of the group. And I have a really strong connection with the higher power today that I know that keeps me sober. And just to learn how to apply that saying about one day at a time, because for me, I've had to piecemeal my days, meaning I have to, you know, break it down. When I first got sober, I could only stay sober for an hour at a time, a minute at a time, whatever it is. And no matter what you guys taught me from my first meeting, keep coming back. Go to meetings, get a sponsor, and do those things. And suit up and show up. I mean, even if you're a couple days sober, you can still do service work by saying hello to somebody that's sitting in a corner over there. And that's what I've been given, and that's what I was taught. Just kind of where I was born in St. Paul, Minnesota, and some people used to like to call me a St. Pauli girl, but that's a whole other story. And, you know, I came from, I was born there, but I moved to Baltimore when I was 4, so when people ask me where I'm from, I say that I'm from Baltimore, because that's where I know, that's where I grew up, that's home to me. There was 4 of us in my family. I'm the third out of 4 kids, so I'm right in the middle. 3 girls and a boy, 2 older sisters, and then I have a younger brother. When I got sober, I didn't know that anybody's family was any different than mine. I just didn't know what that, I didn't hear the word dysfunction until I got into the rooms of AA. So my barometer for normalcy was dysfunction, because that's what it was like in my family. And, you know, there was furniture being thrown, people being slapped. I mean, it was a lot of crazy making. And I'm the only one in my family in the program, but I certainly have plenty of my family members, and yes, I'm taking their inventory, that could use a program. My dad, growing up, I always saw him from a little girl come home, and he went straight, we had a bar, and he went straight to the bar, and I didn't know what it was he was doing. I just knew, I called it a fancy drink, and every day when he got home, I said, "Dad, I want a fancy drink," but, you know, I was like 5 years old, "Dad, I want a fancy drink," and his version of fancy drink for me was, you know, like the cranberry and orange juice with the umbrella in it. So I associated feeling good and relaxing, whatever, with fixing a fancy drink. And I had 2 sisters that were, you know, uprooted out of Minnesota at a really critical time in their life and moved to Baltimore, and they got into that time period that was all sex, drugs, and rock and roll. And because of all the chaos in our family and changes in school and all this stuff and sex, drugs, and rock and roll and everything, my parents said, you know, "You have to do it our way." And both of my sisters said, "Screw you, we're out of here." And so ever since I was young and a very young child, my parents said, "If you turn out like your sisters, we're never going to speak to you again, and we're going to cut you off." So I made it a point later on in life to be worse than they ever could have imagined my sisters being. And I wore that title well. And, you know, I started internalizing things at a very young age. One of the big turning points in my life is that my parents saw my sisters kind of going by the wayside in school and not dropping out of school and doing all this stuff. They're like, "Well, we can't really afford it, but we're going to take them, my brother and myself, out of public school, put them in private school. Hopefully they'll get a better education. We'll keep them away from those people." Well, the biggest mistake that they didn't realize that when you go to a private school, they're the kids with all the money for the drugs and the alcohol. So when I went to private school, I was very insecure because I went into this school not having what other people had, and this barometer that these were blue bloods and all this kind of stuff. So I internalized those things, but I immediately connected with somebody that her family structure was very much like mine. She had 2 older sisters. She had a younger brother. Both of our dad's names was Bill, and our brother's name was Bill. And we always acted older for our age because we had older sisters. So we were at the beach one summer, and I was 10 and a half. And these older kids, a couple of them were younger lifeguards, they started smoking this, what we call this funny cigarette. And I was like, "Oh, that's really cool. I want to try a funny cigarette." So I was 10 and a half when I started using. And I know people are like, "Well, how did you get away?" But see, I learned at a very young age how to get away with things and how to manipulate and how to lie and how to pretend that everything was okay, because that's what I was taught to do. Because in my family, with all the chaos that was going on behind closed doors, the throwing of the furniture, the slapping, the hitting, all this, never let anybody know what's going on behind closed doors. Always walk outside of that front door, be an actress, and it's Leave It to Beaver time. It's You know, you have to be on stage. And so when I came into the program and you guys taught me about honesty, I didn't know what that part in the four step was about rigorous honesty, but I know what that is today. I know the difference between cash register honesty and true heartfelt honesty. I mean, I know what it is to pay somebody back and also what it is to amend my behavior today. So at a young age, I learned how to be a chameleon. As I went on, and I think that was in the sixth grade, and then I was introduced to some other kids. And this is still in private school. I mean, we weren't out smoking pot in our uniform in the courtyard, but I felt different because I came from public school, and I was so used to planning my outfits because that's what I did even as a little girl. And when I got to private school, I was pissed because I had to wear a uniform like everybody else. I didn't want to be like everybody else. So that was a bit of an adjustment. But as I grew in middle school with my friends and stuff like that, I started drinking more and more with my friends and smoking more pot. But everybody was doing the same thing. And nobody would have really known at that point, except for the fact I could hold my liquor longer, and I could beat everybody when it came to whatever it was. And I had some other issues that I, became active in and didn't start experimenting with. I went on through high school, graduated high school, and it was just assumed that you go on to college. And I went on to college, and because it was a college preparatory high school, and the biggest reason I wanted to go out of state was just to get away. It was a geographic cure for me. I knew that way I wouldn't have to be underneath my parents' household, and I could do whatever I wanted to. And so how that enabled me was my alcoholism and drug addiction was just to heighten it. And so when I went away to school, I immediately hooked up with the people that I knew could party the way I partied. But the thing is, I wanted people to like me, so I learned how to be a chameleon at a very young age. I could get along with any group of people. And, when I got into the rooms, I've learned how to just be who I am to some degree. I mean, I can't speak for anybody else, but I know for me, self-esteem has always been a tough thing to work on. And I still struggle with that. I mean, I'm just a student in this thing. I'm just still trying to grow. And I went away to college, and it was a geographic cure, and of course, the geographic cure didn't stick for long because I was on academic probation. But I do need to backtrack. I left out one really major, major thing. There was a huge turning point in my life in 19, well, I won't say the year, then you know how old I am, but when I was, after I tried pot when I was 10 and a half, when I was 12, no, I was 11, my dad was out of town, my mom got a phone call, and my eldest sister that I was really close to, and we looked very, very much alike, she was killed in a car accident by a drunk driver. That was a profound thing that happened in our life and in my life. What happened prior to that was that January, my grandmother, my father's mother died unexpectedly of a heart attack that was misdiagnosed. And then my dad was in the hospital a month later from stress with a heart attack. And then my sister died. So all this happened between January and April. And that was a huge, profound thing that happened to me in my life at that age. And that was a huge turning point. And I knew right then from my parents' example about what it was like to stuff your feelings and to shut the door on things, that you don't talk about things, you shut the door and you move on and you just keep stuffing them. And that's what I did. And I drank and I smoked pot, and that's how I dealt with that. And so by the time I graduated high school and by the time I went away to college, I mean, I was really blossoming in my addiction by then. So I did a really good job my freshman year of going to school in Lynchburg, Virginia. I proceeded to get on academic probation. I was really proud of that, the first semester and the second semester. My parents were not very proud of that. So they made me come home, and I was a manipulative, I was a liar, and I was a cheat. And I told them, and I bartered, and I did all this stuff, and said, I'm going to do better next time. And they said, well, you got to come home, and you got to prove yourself. So I went home to Baltimore, and did that for a little bit, and then I did another geographic year. And I decided I needed another move. And I have family in Louisiana, so I went to school in Louisiana. I just said, okay, I'm going to move to Louisiana. So I moved down there, and what happened for me down there was I became a big fish in a small pond because I didn't dress like everybody else. I certainly didn't speak like everybody else. I didn't say y'all. I do now once in a while. Let's see. I had a car that stood out on campus. I had, I had car tags that read Maryland instead of Louisiana, so that stood out. And I just, things just escalated, but somehow I always seemed to end up with the people that had the drugs and that were using and drinking the way I was. And for me, that was no coincidence. And, and along this whole path, I did have several relationships with men that were tragically just, I don't know about anybody else being in recovery, but I don't have such a good track record with that. What can I say? But it was just, they were train wrecks, basically. And so there was a lot of abuse with that. But see, I saw that growing up, so I didn't know any different. And I didn't have any recovery in me, so how could I know any different? And so I carried all that dysfunction with me for years and years and years. And I got down to Louisiana. I immediately, I was filled with ego. Here I was, this girl from the north. Everybody knew me on campus as the girl from the north that talks funny, drives convertible, all that kind of stuff. And that just fueled my ego and fueled my addiction and fueled everything that I did. And, literally, by God's grace, I got out of every time I was pulled over. Maybe it was the accent, I don't know. Maybe it probably has something to do with what I had on in the car. I have no idea, but probably. As things would have it, there was a huge, huge sting operation with this undercover thing in Louisiana, and these were all friends of mine I ended up dealing ecstasy, and I was pretty good at it too. And I'm not proud of that, but I had a little extra cash on the side, and I never had to, because of that, I had a lot of free drugs because I knew the right people and I was in the right places and that kind of thing. But I was also in the right place at the right time for one incident that there was an after hours club, and everybody went out there and doing all the, drinking and using and all this stuff. And this girl called me and she said, we're having a party at my place, why don't you come over? And I don't know what it was, but I thought, I think I'm okay. I think I'm going to stay here and party with these guys. Well, the next day, the next day for me, I know for sure I got in probably at like 5:30 that morning or something, or didn't go to bed at all. And for some reason, I turned on the TV and the news was on. And on the TV, they were marching all of my friends that were at that party, handcuffed out from that party. And she was the narc that was setting everybody up. And every single one of those people spent more than 10 years in jail. And if that's not divine intervention, I don't know what is, because that would have been me. Without a question at all. And I do believe for me that there's no coincidences in life, that this program is built on divine intervention, and the fact that, you know, there's been divine intervention in my life. And so what happened there is I moved back to Baltimore, and, you know, because my parents just decided that, you know, I'd pretty much worn my welcome out down there because I, you know, had blown through however much money they'd given me for to help me out for a semester, and I was working two jobs to help with tuition and all that, but I'd blown through all that within a matter of 2 weeks, and it was just the last 3 months. And so I didn't really have any recourse, and that was in 1987. And you know, that incident where all my friends were arrested on TV, that should have woken me up, but it didn't. It just made me dig deeper and say, well, that's not going to happen to me. And, you know, so I came to, moved back to Baltimore and just became miserable and drank every single day. My friends in Baltimore that I hung out with from high school that had now become, in their own rights, further down into the bottle and drugs and stuff like that. You know, we all just, you know, just, what's that word, we're enabled each other. We just really enabled each other. And, you know, it wasn't a pretty sight, but I was constantly searching. And there was this hole in my soul that the wind just blew through. It was just an empty vessel. And, you know, in the big book, it talks about that we're not a glum lot, and we're going to have a host of friends. And I have a host of friends today. And I didn't have any real friends. And I have a family that I've made in these rooms today. And, you know, I may not know all of you guys, and there's a ton of people here I don't know. But I'm here tonight because I want to stay sober. And when I got here, I was completely spiritually, mentally, emotionally, and physically bankrupt. And, you know, so I kept digging in that bottle, and I kept digging in the drugs when I moved back to Baltimore. And then my dad he was in this big company, and anyways, he had a big takeover. Long story short is he had to end up here in Atlanta. And at that time, I didn't have anything left in Baltimore. I had no finances left. I was barely holding on to a job. I had lost every kind of real friendship that I thought I had. And so when my dad said that he had to come down here, I didn't have a choice but to come. And looking back, I know now, today, that I wouldn't be here today if I would have stayed in Baltimore. If I would have stayed and continued to do what I was doing then, I wouldn't have been alive. I know that for sure. But somehow, you know, that I moved down here in August of 88. And I reconnected with some of my friends that I'd gone to school with in Louisiana. I found out that they were living here in Atlanta. And I thought I was a crazy using person at that time until I met up with them again. And these are people that I used to deal with, and I used to do coke with, and I used to drink with. And, you know, alcohol was a constant. It was always, I mean, they were from New Orleans, so that should tell you something right there. I mean, it's 24 hours a day there. I mean, there's no stopping. And so I was able to hook up with them. And one thing I know for sure about Atlanta is I hated it. No offense to anybody in this room. I mean, this is just my experience. That's not the way it is today. But I hated Atlanta when I moved here. And I'll tell you why. Because I grew up in the Northeast. Washington, D.C. was my playground. And New York was right up the street, it seemed like. And it was very cosmopolitan. And I thought, how in the hell hotel am I ending up in Atlanta? I mean, I do remember when I moved here, and it's so weird, it's not there anymore. It was on Peachtree right near the Brookhaven MARTA station. There was a sailing school there, and I couldn't figure out where the beach was. I mean, there was a sailing school. There was a big ship or boat or something, and I didn't know that Lake Lanier was right around the corner. I had no idea, but I thought that was the most random thing I'd ever seen in my life, that there was a sailing school in Buckhead. I was like, are you kidding me? This is where I've ended up. But so, you know, everybody just kind of talked funny and stuff like that. But my last year was really tough. You know, I'd found a job here, a job there, and I'd lost the job that I'd moved down here with. I transferred with a company here, and I basically just quit that because it interfered with my using and drinking. And you have to understand, my drinking was a 24-hour-a-day job. Like, I woke up thinking about how I was going to get my drink, and then I didn't drink at lunchtime. I thought, well, no, I can't do that. I'll just wait until 5 o'clock. And but at the end of my drinking, I was living with my parents, and I would stop and get a big bottle of the plastic bottle of, I can't remember what it was called, of vodka. I was a gin drinker, but I switched to vodka because it was cheaper, apparently. Or it didn't smell or something. I don't know exactly, but maybe both of those things. And I would go get a glass of ice, and I put like 2 ice cubes in it, and another glass of like this much orange juice, and I go into my upstairs and say goodnight. This would be 6:30 at nighttime, and say goodnight and say, it's been a long day. And I would go upstairs and I would drink. And I would just drink and drink and drink and drink in the back of my closet. I mean, the light was on, but it's the back of my closet. But where I hit my bottom was out of state. I went with my friends that were from New Orleans, Louisiana, and it was going to be for 4th of July weekend. And we had rented a condo out of state, and I've not been back to that place since I hit my bottom. That's just for me. I don't know if I'll ever go back there, because I can still visualize what it was like when I left. So we went out of town, and the picture that this was literally was, there was no food involved with any situation. It was only alcohol and cocaine and drugs. That's all there was. And you know, the liquid was to keep us hydrated, of course, and then the other was to keep us awake. And I was on like a 4-day bender. There was no sleeping involved. And there was a situation that came up. There was, I wasn't in a blackout, but I was reaching out for help. I really was reaching out for help. I picked up a knife and stabbed myself. And, you know, I'm grateful I still have the scars today, because I know that it reminds me of what it was like and what it doesn't have to be like. And, you know, they say in the program, do not regret the past, nor wish to shut the door on it, but to use that and hopefully share your experience to help somebody else. But I, like I said, going back to divine intervention, I had to go to the hospital, long story short, lots of blood and all this kind of stuff. So they took me to the hospital, whatever they did there, wrapped me up, and put me in the back of the police car. I thought they were taking me to jail, but they took me back to the condo where we were staying. And the police officer, to this day, who knows if he was in the program, but what he said was, he said, you know, there's another way to live. There's a group of people out there that do this thing called life, and they don't use drugs, and they don't drink, and they have a pretty damn good life. And I didn't think about that until I was a couple months sober. But I look back now, and that really, for me, was God working through other people. And, you know, So it took what it took, and I, you know, my family, like I said, they probably could all use a program. You know, the Leave It to Beaver syndrome that they still had when I came back to Atlanta, my mom's like, oh, don't worry, honey, you know, I'll make a pot roast, everything will be fine, and it's fine. It's all fine. And that's not the way it was. So I went to my first meeting, and It was a nighttime meeting at Triangle, and before that, though, we called AA, but I didn't call AA. I had my mom call because I was afraid you guys would recognize my voice. I've never called AA before in my entire life, but I thought you might recognize my voice, and so I made her call, and so went to my first meeting, and I told this, friends of mine know this story, that I can still remember what I had on at my first meeting, that I had a pair of camouflage pants on and a flannel shirt that didn't match, which everybody that knows me knows that that is totally out of character for me. So, but I can tell you that I probably could still count and tell you how many pebbles there were on the ground the day that I walked to my first meeting, up to the first meeting there, because I was so defeated and my head was so far down to the ground that I didn't look up at anybody. And when I got there, I sat in the back of the room, and I didn't say a word to anybody. I just shook. I was petrified. I had long sleeves on. It was the middle of the summertime, probably like 100 degrees, and I had flannels on. I mean, go figure. But you know what? The cool thing about it, nobody cared. Nobody looked at me funny. Nobody said, why do you have that on? What they did do is they opened up their mouth and they shared and they talked about what was going on with them. And I felt like you guys had been in my head all those years before I got there. And they were telling my story. And one thing that I do remember is I can still see the faces of some of the people there as you guys told me to keep coming back. But I didn't totally buy into this whole I'm an alcoholic thing at first because I didn't want to say that I was an alcoholic. I was too afraid. And I was just pissed off to be here. I mean, I was just mad at everybody. But I do remember that I was one of those people that snuck my white chip because I didn't want anybody to see me get my white chip. And I was trying to be really cool about it where at the end of the meeting, they'd given out the chips, and it was at a women's meeting, and the lady, they'd lined them up on the desk or whatever, and so I went up to the lady, and I pointed, I said, I need one of those, and I kind of just looked over my shoulder. She said, one of what? And she was real loud and real happy, and I was like, oh my God, just calm down. And, you know, just seriously, just calm down. It's not that big of a deal. And so she said, oh, that's great. Well, about 10 women come up to me, and I was like, really? Do we have to make a big deal about this? And so, and I didn't say anything to anybody for a long time, but I do remember getting, right before I got my 30-day chip, this lady that had been sitting next to me, apparently she'd been counting every day I've been sober, and she nudged me, and she said, you're coming up on 30 days, and I was like, oh my God, who made her the chip checker? I mean, you know, and so, but, you know, for anybody out there that's shy, that doesn't want to get their chips in front of it, it's totally cool. And but you know, that changed later on. I started picking up chips because what people told me is it gives people hope for coming in the rooms and keep coming back. And you know, one thing that I will say, what it's like today is you know, there's been so many opportunities that I've had to do things in recovery. And, you know, when I was younger, I didn't really touch much on about, you know, not feeling, didn't feel a part of, but I also was not very smart. And back then, they didn't really pay attention to that. And I had a pretty severe case of dyslexia. And later on in life, that came out. And I was always insecure about that. And because my brother was the golden child of the family, and did everything by the book, and graduated college in 4 years, not 10. So the gifts of the program for me have been the fact that, you know, for me there's three words that really describe about how my sobriety is today: commitment, discipline, and responsibility. I have a commitment to my higher power every day to get up and get on my knees. And I have a discipline to want to stay sober and stay in the middle of the bed of the program. I have a responsibility to you guys, to my higher power, and through that I can be of service to my sponsees and reciprocally to my friends and family of origin and all those other things. But one of the biggest gifts, and probably one of the things I'm most proud of, is the fact that I went back and fulfilled one of my lifelong dreams, because I had this huge chip on my shoulder that I hadn't finished my degree in college. So I was about, however many years sober. Went back to school, worked 4 jobs, was in school full time, and I graduated on the dean's list with a 4.0. And for somebody that has dyslexia, that's no big deal to anybody else. It's a big deal to me. And, so the biggest thing that I can tell you today that has changed is that I do have a host of friends, and the people that that have given me the most in my life today are the people that I sponsor, because they're a great reflection of myself, and they show me how I can improve on my program. And, just seeing faces here that I don't know, it really gives me hope, and, I'm really grateful. I've had an opportunity to go travel all over the world and go to meetings outside of this country. It's phenomenal to do that. And the commonality of this program is that the language of the heart. We all speak the same thing. And, I've had an opportunity to go to the International Convention in San Diego, and holding hands, I think there was 80,000 people in a stadium saying the Lord's Prayer. That was a pretty powerful experience. And when I was a couple years sober, we helped host IQPA, which is the International Conference of Young People in AA. I was on the host committee, and we had 4,500 young people here. And you don't have to be young to get on that. You can be old like me, too. I don't know what time it is. I'm a little early, I think. But I know I probably left a lot out, and I know a friend of mine was looking for me to say a bunch of the lurid details, but that didn't happen tonight, apparently. So, I'm really grateful to be sober. I'm grateful to try and be of service, and I'm just grateful you guys are here today. Thanks.
Just in case anybody missed about it for the first time, I'm going to pass this up. It's coming in after. Seven tradition states that when the dues are paid, that your generosity helps us bring you great speakers like this, get their stories if they release them on the internet, and with NavaClub.org. NavaClub.org is the audio library. You'll find about 90 speakers there these days. And I've asked Mark T. to hand out the chips.
Whoa, I didn't. Yeah, I'm Mark, I'm an alcoholic. And, is that right?
Yeah,
I'm like Lisa. I only picked up chips one time myself. So, does anybody want to pick up a white chip? Surrender. And I thought when I picked this up, my life was the end. I didn't realize it was the beginning. And then next, we have this crushed beer can. I would read it to you, but I ain't got my glasses. I want to now wear glasses for 30 days. Come on. This is what, 60? 90. 90 days?
Red chip.
Red chip for 90. And yellow for 6 months. It ain't nothing yellow about being having 6 months sober. And green, I heard him say that the grass is grown back between you and the liquor store. Somebody need that? And of course, I lived under the bridge. I didn't have no grass. Does anybody need a blue chip? I thought it was, I was cutting back. I didn't want to have no rent to pay. And I enjoyed your story. I guess I'll have to wait for the book to come back to hear the details. And thank you for letting me give the chips out.
Okay. We can make announcements now if you have any. Anybody like to make an announcement? Any related announcement? Yes, Tim.
Next Monday night, you will have another group of people saying, hey, and we have a few people help us set the room up, put the coffee, clear the coffee away, and get this factory ready to set the room. You guys will talk about it in another room.
Okay, and then the week after that, Bernita P. comes back. She'd been originally scheduled last month and was delayed getting here. Showed up and with a lot of willingness and desire, but a little bit late. So we rescheduled her for December the 13th. And that's Bernita P. Yes, thank you.
Yes, thank you. I'll call up the good at it. Everybody, there are the new rooms in the code meeting at Triangle. I'm going to be meditating here, but when we do leave them, you can come by. Please stay at 12, and there has been a district rooms meeting on Thursday at 12.
Okay, so ladies' meetings at Triangle now at noon on Tuesdays and Thursdays. Okay. Well, if everybody's ready, I'd like to remind everybody that anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities. For those who will, please join us in the Lord's Prayer.
Power and glory forever and ever. Amen. He's coming back for the earth.